Today at Reader's Corner, Rob Hart, author of the new thriller, Assassins Anonymous. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our guest today is novelist Rob Hart, author of the USA Today best-selling thriller, Assassins Anonymous. The novel follows an infamous killer for hire who gives up the violent life only to find himself under siege by assailants unknown. He must choose between slipping back into his old ways or his new life as a reformed hitman. Rob Hart is the author of Assassins Anonymous, The Paradox Hotel, The Warehouse, and the Ash McKenna crime series, and co-author with James Patterson of Scott Free. Rob Hart, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, Rob, I just gave a very brief description of the novel. Why don't you give us the safe version of this plot? And by that, I just mean we don't want to give away anything readers deserve to get on their own. And boy, there's a lot of that that readers can't figure out when they start your novel. So tell us what we can know about this novel. I certainly enjoyed it, and I know our readers will as well.
Well, the easiest way I can describe it is basically John Wick gets into a recovery program for killers.
Uh-huh.
And so it's about a hitman named Mark who used to go by the stage name The Pale Horse. And he was once the world's deadliest assassin. And then one day decided he didn't want to kill anymore because, you know, some bad stuff happened. And he gets into a recovery program for killers. And then one day after a meeting, someone tries to kill him. And he realizes, A, how difficult it is to defend himself now that he can't actually kill people. But B, you know, he kind of has to figure out who's after him. So he's getting drawn back into this world that he's been trying so hard to leave behind.
And you called this book the love letter to the genre of hitmen and thrillers. Did I get that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're quite the fan of these books. And tell us a little bit about where you mentioned John Wick. And by the way, there's probably a lot of our listeners who don't read thrillers. And I hope they will after they listen to you and I talk about this. But you might just share who this Wick character is, if they haven't been on Netflix recently anyway. And then any other, you mentioned a number of different authors and movies that play a role in getting you to this point with this book.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the John Wick movies, which I highly recommend, although you have to have a bit of a stomach for violence, are
right.
About another deadliest hitman in the world type of character played by Keanu Reeves, who in the first movie, he's retired and a bunch of thugs kill his dog. And so he ends up, you know, slaughtering hundreds and hundreds of people in increasingly frenetic and creative ways. But there's also a lot of great classics that I kind of went back to, like Day of the Jackal by Forsythe. It ended up becoming a Richard Gere and a Bruce Willis movie, which is really good. And then there's some greats in the genre that I really like Chris Holm and Yasmin Ango and people who are writing about these characters. Because, you know, what interests me about the hitman character is they're sort of this archetype character, same way as the private eye or the gunslinger or the samurai. They're someone who sort of like operates outside of the law, because the law, as we know, isn't always just. And they're a little bit more minded in achieving justice, even if it means kind of skirting around the law.
Yeah. You also mentioned 3 Days of the Condor. And I must say, I'm not one that can go back and recall all the different kinds of movies I've seen, but I have never forgotten the opening few minutes of 3 Days of the Condor with Robert Redford going out for a sandwich.
You know, I got to tell you, so that's based on a book called 6 Days of the Condor by James Grady. And I've since become like very good friends with Jim.
Oh, really?
And besides the fact that he is just like the nicest dude on the planet. A couple of years back, we had this great event at a movie theater in New York where we did a showing of 3 Days of the Condor, and then he and I did a Q&A about it afterward. And it's probably the most fun I've ever had in a movie theater.
Okay, so we get that on YouTube?
No, unfortunately. No. We didn't think far enough ahead in terms of like actually recording it and posting it.
Okay.
But yeah, you know, and that's another great example, like his character in that, Joubert, who is like a sort of like he's an incredibly deadly hitman, but who has like a very strict moral code, who actually, you know, at parts of the movie displays like a surprising level of kindness.
Yes.
And I think it's a good reminder that like these people, they're still people, they're still multifaceted. They still have you know, quirks and personalities, and they're still human. They're just doing something that's not all of us are like, you know, right, professional kids. Right. They're doing something very specially trained for.
Yeah. And that really comes through in Assassins Anonymous. And of course, the reviews from one to the other all called your book stellar. But here's what I found interesting in reading your acknowledgments after I finished the novel. I don't think I've had many novelists or even nonfiction writers explained that they stress tested the first chapter of the novel at the Yonder Bar. And you have to tell us about the Yonder Bar and how'd that go? Yonder Bar is in North Carolina. Is that correct?
It is. It is. My buddy Eric Pruitt owns it. He is also a phenomenal novelist and he's a good friend.
Uh-huh.
And so there's this reading series called Noir at the Bar, and it's basically it's kind of like a loose contingent of, you know, people will host readings for crime fiction authors at bars, and they've been done all over the world, though they tend to be focused more in the U.S. And Eric does it every, I think, like four times a year. And then me and my buddy will sometimes drive down there and spend a couple of days hanging out with him and his wife at the bar and, you know, eating good food. And then we do this big event. And the thing that's nice about Yonder is that it's a big crowd of locals who are really into what they're hearing. They love the stories. They love supporting authors. And I had written the first chapter of this book just as sort of like, this would be a fun thing to do, mm-hmm. you know. Right. And I didn't totally have it solidified in my mind yet. But I was like, well, let me read it in front of an audience and see how it goes down. Like, let me see. Because, you know, I'll tell you a little bit secret about authors in general. We're all like, you know, racked with crippling insecurity. We all assume that everything we write is garbage until someone tells us otherwise. Sometimes I just need to read something and just kind of hear it out loud and see how people react to it. And the crowd went wild and people are pulling me aside afterward. They're like, when's the book going to be available? I'm like, I don't know. I got to write it first.
Right.
But it was one of those moments where, you know, there was a lot going on. I just kind of needed a win that day. And it was a pretty big win. And then, you know, that gave me the encouragement I needed to sit down and just finish the book.
Well, one of the best reviews of your book starts off somewhere toward the beginning. The guy says, I thought it was kind of a goofy premise until I started reading it. And that's where I want to go from here, because you also talk to friends in recovery programs. I mean, here we are dealing with a recovery program for assassins, but you point out somewhere, and maybe not directly in your novel, but there is indeed a transfer over to assassin recovery that we know about in Alcoholics Anonymous recovery. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we know that, you know, just because it doesn't have to be a substance to be addictive,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Because gambling can be addictive or sex can be addictive. Right. And, you know, for characters like this, it's like a risk reward thing. It's like they're getting the rush of risking their life. They're getting the reward of praise, of money, of knowing that they're good at what they do. And, you know, one of the things that I did was go to my friends in recovery who were incredibly kind and generous with their time. And, you know, I went to them straight off and said, hey, you know, this is an idea I have. If you think I'm being ridiculous, tell me. But I sort of explained my thinking and sort of the message I got from everyone was like, you know, just don't ever forget that these recovery programs, they saved my life. They save other people's lives. Like, you have to treat that with respect. And so I did my best to do that. And the ones who have read it, you know, since then have basically said like, okay, yeah, you know, this works.
Well, for cat lovers, P. Kitty appears in your novel as a supporting actor. And given how cats have recently entered our national conversation as never before, tell us as much about P. Kitty as you can without ruining the story for our listeners.
Yeah, sure. So I kind of wanted Mark to have a cat. The thing about Mark that I had to be really careful about is that, you know, again, he's a killer. He kills people. And, you know, we know that he's going to do bad things. And I want the reader to like him, because mm-hmm. I feel like if they like him, once he starts doing really bad things, they won't walk away from him. Right. And, you know, a very quick and easy way, you know, this is like a craft thing to humanize a character is to give them a pet.
Yeah.
Because if a pet can love someone, then that person is lovable. And it just struck me as funny. Like, oh, it'd be funny if this, like, you know, incredibly dangerous person just had like a pet cat that he kind of doted over. And, the name for the cat, P. Kitty, that was the name of my grandmother's cat.
Oh, cool.
My brother and sister, when they were little kids, they named it. Uh-huh. And, you know, the cat has since passed and my grandmother has since passed. But it's one of those things where it's like, you know, this would be a fun little tribute that's kind of like an inside joke, and it's for me, but I was surprised at how strongly people latched onto the cat.
I did, for sure. And then, of course, what's really cool is that later on in the novel, we all learn how that cat came to be part of Mark's life. And that's something we don't want to give away.
Which is based on not a completely similar story, but a somewhat similar circumstance that a friend once shared with me. So, I won't say what that is, because that is an important plot point.
Exactly. Today I'm speaking with Rob Hart, author of the new novel Assassins Anonymous. The book is a thrilling story of suspense, murder, and redemption as a reformed hitman tries to stay on the straight and narrow while running for his life. Well, your protagonist, Mark, who also goes by the name The Pale Horse, to those, I think, who are distinctly afraid of him, meets up with a guy from the agency, and that's an agency with a capital A, and he asks if the agency is the CIA, and the answer is no. I wonder, am I naive in thinking that maybe there actually is something like the agency out there beyond the CIA, or is this just the novelist creativity at work?
That's an interesting question, because I think it's, on one hand, it's really easy to think about like conspiracy stories about like a deep state kind of thing, but I also kind of think the government is sort of pretty inept. Their ability to keep things secret is probably not great.
Yeah.
I mean, there are, like, the CIA actually does have a section that's, you know, for sort of like covert military operations. Like, I think it's called like the Special Operations Group or something. Yeah. And then there's like, you know, the Mossad has a section that's like built out literally just for like infiltration and assassination. So I think there's a degree to which, you know, these things might exist and might be happening. But, you know, one of the things I did when I finished this book is you got to go to other authors and you got to ask them for blurbs. And I went to Alma Katsu, and Alma is a fantastic writer. She wrote these two books called Red Widow and Red London.
I've read both.
They're espionage books. Yeah. And the reason I like them so much is because she used to work for the CIA.
Right.
She actually has to have the CIA sign off on her books before she can publish them to make sure she's not, you know, giving away any information that might be, you know, secretive. And when I gave it to Alma, I was like, look, I know that I wrote the Lord of the Rings version of what you actually did in real life. So like, don't judge me too harshly. But she read it and she enjoyed it. She had a good time. But that's the thing too. It's like you're playing in this sort of like heightened reality space where you get to, you know, take some liberties.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Alma Katsu, I follow her. I've read what she has done. She's got a brand new one out, I believe. And she wrote a really nice brief for you on the back of the book. Let's talk a little bit about the various places you go to get your background, your information, your inspiration for doing these kinds of things. Jason Statham comes up. I am a fan of Jason Statham, and I've seen all of his movies. We already mentioned John Wick. What about Gross Point Blank and The Professional? The Professional especially, I think you might have called that the most important influence in your work.
Oh yeah, The Professional is my favorite, probably my favorite movie ever. Uh-huh. There's just something really, you know, beautiful about that sort of, you know, Jean Reno is so good in that he's playing an Italian hitman who, you know, ends up taking in a 12-year-old Natalie Portman after her family is killed by corrupt cops. And it sort of subverts that genre a little bit, because on one hand, like, he's an incredibly capable, incredibly dangerous person who is also very sad and very tender and has almost like this childless, like childlike sense to him because of the traumas that he experienced that sort of, you know, arrested his development a little bit. So there is one inside joke about Gross Point Blank from the book that I'll reveal here that I think is fine. It doesn't really do anything with the plot. So, you know, at one point there's a character who's quizzing Mark about all these hitman movies, about their level of accuracy.
Right.
And she asks him if he saw Gross Point Blank, and he's like, no, I just don't buy John Cusack as a killer. That is actually, I have not seen Gross Point Blank. So that was my little nod to that. I should watch it. It feels like a gap at this point.
Well, I feel I have to mention the reveal that comes later in your book. I can't possibly reveal it, but I just think it's important for listeners to know that you're reading along in this novel, this thriller, and you're trying to figure everything out. And then something comes along that explains why Mark wants to give up being an assassin. And I mean, it is a very clever handling of plot. Maybe you can at least comment on it without telling us what it is, because like I said, that's the greatest shocker of your book, I think.
Yeah, obviously can't talk about specifics, but I will say there was a degree that in my original drafts, that scene didn't play out the way that it plays out in the book. I tried to play it a little bit safe because I didn't want to go too far. And then my agent was like, no, no, you got to do it. You got to go all the way. And I was like, okay, man. Okay. and it was absolutely the right call. But that's the great thing about having a great team, a great agent, a great editor, is they can see where, you know, there's a potential for the story to be better than it is. Yeah. And they kind of like push you in that direction.
Yeah. And we'll tell us a little bit about the role of that, that editor. Every novelist or author I've had on the show certainly goes through that stage of the writing. What's it do for you?
I think for me, I know that I'm ready to send a book in when I know that there might still be problems with it or things that aren't necessarily working, but I'm struggling to see them or understand them. You know, they're kind of like scratching at the back of my head, but they're not very clear to me. And then it's great because you're not only giving it to a fresh set of eyes, you're giving it to someone who does this for a living. And, you know, my editor, Daphne, is phenomenal. You know, my agent, Josh, is incredible. And, you know, you find yourself in this place of like, you know, you thought you did the best job you possibly could. And they send you like a 10-page letter explaining all the things that you could do better.
Yeah.
But they're right. You know, and I love that. Like, and that's something that I'm not sure people really understand is how collaborative this process is. Like, we sort of romanticize this idea of a writer sitting by themselves and like, you know, creating this thing. And, you know, yeah, that's part of it. But also part of it is the input that I'm getting from my team, you know, or even just other writer friends. Like when I'm sitting in bars with them and just like talking through plot stuff. I have a buddy named Todd Robinson who wrote this incredible book called The Hard Bounce. And I remember there was something I was really, really struggling with in the book and I just couldn't see my way around it. And I was explaining to him and he goes, oh, do this. Oh. And it was like, oh, that's perfect. You know, and it's like sometimes you need that extra set of eyes or that extra opinion to really sort of fully realize where it is that you need to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So James Patterson has been called the most popular storyteller of our time. And here you are, a young man who teams up with him to write, I guess, what you'd call a short novel entitled Scot Free. How did that partnership come about? And are you going to do that again?
So that came out of going to a conference and sitting at a bar and talking to an editor at Hachette. And they talked about how they wanted to start doing short, like novella length, novel like novella length stories called book shots and do like a couple of them a month. So when you pick up a normal like what you would assume is like a normal size novel in a bookstore, that's probably about 75,000 to 80,000 words. Mm-hmm. And so a book shot was only going to be 30,000 words. You know, it was going to be almost like a third of a standard novel. And unfortunately, the program didn't work out. You know, they did a bunch of them and then people were just struggling to keep up with the release of so many. But I mean, as an experience, it was amazing. I mean, I learned so much from him in terms of weaving together character and plot and story momentum and trusting the reader and giving them things that they can understand. I would love to do it again, but honestly, my plate is so full right now. Sure. And some with collaborations with other people too. So
yeah,
you know, one day I would love to go back to that.
Well, you've already written the sequel to Assassins Anonymous. When is that going to be released? When will we see that at the bookstores?
So that should be coming out next summer. And that's also an interesting situation because I can't really talk about it too much yet. Because it follows another character from the book. The first book.
Yeah.
You know, Mark is still there, but it's now this other character, their story as well.
Yeah.
And their background and how they came to where they are and why they decided to quit. And I bet since you've read it, you can probably guess who I'm talking about and why. Yep. I can't say who it is.
Yes, I can.
Yeah. So and that one, that is so it's called the Medusa Protocol, and mm-hmm. It's a fun one. It's definitely it's a little bit crazier than this one, but I had a good time writing it.
Oh, that's the Medusa Protocol. All right, well, watch for that. Assassins Anonymous has already been optioned for a movie, and Rob Howard picked up the rights to The Warehouse in 2019. Any developments on either one of those?
No.
That's not unusual. Hollywood
is, yeah. No, it's not. So actually, with The Warehouse, the option expired with Ron Howard, and then Village Roadshow picked it up, and now they're developing it for TV. As for Assassins, that was optioned by Spielberg and Amblin for a potential film series. And yeah, I don't know exactly what's going on there. But we're just coming out of the summer. So, you know, everyone's just getting back to their desks. I've heard there's been some good developments, but you know, the Hollywood stuff is so weird, man. It's like, I go into this assuming it's not going to happen because I'd rather be surprised than disappointed. It's like, you can't bet on it because, you know, I know authors who've had their works optioned for years and years and years and never saw anything get made of it. Mm-hmm. We're also in like a weird period with Hollywood where they're coming out of the strikes, you know, the streaming wars are kind of over and they've realized that streaming is not really a lucrative model.
Yeah.
So it's a big transition period. So yeah, honestly, like I don't give it too much thought.
Yeah.
I would love if it happened because, mm-hmm. you know, who doesn't want to go see their book right. get turned into a movie?
Right.
But I don't know. I'm kind of hoping that maybe in the next month or two we'll hear some developments and then we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that we've interviewed a good number of people on Reader's Corner who have had their rights optioned. And to your point, nothing ever seems to happen. And I think that's probably due, first of all, just to the amount of product that is being shoved onto the bookshelves. I mean, there's so many great novelists out there doing this stuff, not just thrillers, but in general. And so choosing from among those, if you're over in Hollywood, is probably quite the chore. But secondly, just so we understand this, the inside business, is this mainly about the fact that, okay, we have this great novel called The Warehouse and it's been optioned. Now, whoever picked it up has to figure out a way to produce it. And that means finding the funding to pay for the movie. And that's quite the chore these days, I suppose. Is that basically exactly. That's what's holding these things up, right?
Yeah. So the way like the inside baseball version of it is that, you know, they get a book in that they want to turn into either a TV show or a movie or whatever. So what they try to do is what's called packaging. And that's hiring a screenwriter to put together like a script or a pilot script, if it's a TV show, trying to hire a showrunner, if it's a movie, a director, and then you try to attach like one or two big name actors who mm-hmm. are going to, you know, get people to sit up and take notice. Mm-hmm. And then once you have that package, you can go out and say to, you know, a movie studio or Netflix, say like, hey, I've got this. You know, if you go into Netflix and you say, hey, I've got this idea, they're going to be like, okay, cool. Like, come back to us when you have something. But if you go in and say, you know, I've got this book and we wrote this script by these people and this guy wants to be the showrunner and Tom Cruise wants to be the star, they're going to be like, oh, that's awesome. Let's start uh-huh. talking about budget.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. So it doesn't seem to me that the author of the novel is seldom or is ever used as the screenwriter. And I'm always curious as to what is this difference? Is it just the fact that, hey, Hollywood hires screenwriters and novel maker, good for you, but we're going to take your book and you can butt out now. And there are occasions, I think, where there's an exception to the rule, but what's the deal? Why does it take a screenwriter to have your book make any sense on the screen?
Well, I think to a degree, screenwriting is a different language than novel writing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the romance languages. They all have the same roots, but they're all different enough that it's not always easy to understand between the two. And I have a buddy, Jordan Harper, who has option. He works in TV. He's a novelist. He's had all of his stuff optioned. He wrote a book called She Rides Shotgun that won the Edgar a few years ago, and the movie version is coming out in like a year or something. And he said, the biggest mistake he made was negotiating the right to write the screenplay because he was like, I can't see past the story. I can't see to the things that need to be changed. You can't just shoot a book the way it is in the book. The best example I can give you is in The Warehouse. So The Warehouse is basically about like if Amazon completely took over the American economy. And one of the main characters is the CEO of this fictional company who is sort of litigating his history and creating this business. And all of his chapters are blog posts. So you can't do blog posts in a movie. You would have to figure out a way to like get him on the screen and like weave these story elements into a more, active setting. Yet you really, I think you need people who are a little bit more mindful toward what that's going to look like on a screen. I mean, there are always options. Like, for example, if I option something for TV, I'll always try to negotiate that I can write at least one episode of the season. And that's generally something that a lot of companies will say, okay, yeah, sure, no problem. Because the idea is that if I do a really bad job, they'll just rewrite it. If I do a good job, that's great. But if I do a bad job, they'll take care of it. And that kind of suits me because look, I'll like if The Warehouse becomes a TV show and I get to write an episode one season, like that would be awesome. But I've never written a screenplay before, and I'm not going to write a screenplay for Assassins Anonymous and have my first screenplay go to Steven Spielberg. Like that's just not going to happen.
I hear you. Well, you've mentioned some authors and some books that I think will really be interesting for our listeners. I heard The Hard Bounce, and I heard She Rides Shotgun. I heard about the author Eric Pruitt and Alma Katsu, who I also have read. Give us some thoughts on your reading. Where do you go and make some recommendations for our listeners besides your work? Where's a good place to spend some time?
Oh wow. It's funny because I can sit here for the next 3 hours and do that because I'm very lucky in the sense that I'm part of like a very big, very cool community of writers who are all very supportive of each other. I can tell you my good friend Alex Segura has a book coming out later this year called Alter Ego that is very much worth looking for. It's a murder mystery set within the comic book industry, which is pretty cool. There's S.A. Cosby, who wrote, All the Sinners Bleed and Blacktop Wasteland and Razorblade Tears, who, besides being one of the hottest writers in the game right now, is also just the nicest dude I've ever met. I just picked up a book called The Expat by Hanson Shi, which I'm very excited to dig into. And you know what? If someone's looking for a really deep cut, this is a small press book. Right. It came out from a publisher called Clash Books. And smaller press means it just doesn't get as much attention, doesn't get in as many bookstores. But it's called The Man Who Saw Seconds by Alexandre Baldassare. And it is probably the wildest thriller I've ever read. It's about this guy who has like this weird form of precognition where he can see 5 seconds into the future. So he can kind of make decisions based on what's in front of him. And he makes a very silly mistake at the beginning of the book, and it ends up turning into like this big global catastrophe. It's one of those books where I literally cleared my calendar for a day just so I can sit down and finish reading it.
So it's The Man Who Saw Seconds by Alexander.
Baltazar.
Well, this is outstanding. Not only have our listeners somewhere to go as far as the Assassins Anonymous, and by the way, I went back and just bought a copy of your first Ash McKenna book, New Yorked. So I look forward to getting into that series as well. But you've given us some great suggestions, and on your own work, please keep it up. Let's keep this thing going here and hear more from the Pale Horse and some of the people in that novel, Assassins Anonymous.
Thank you. I'm excited for that. I'm hoping that I get to write some more in this series. And I've actually got another book coming out, and that's a book that I co-wrote with my buddy Alex Segura, and that's called Dark Space. It's basically if John Le Carré was writing Star Trek. It's like space espionage.
Rob Hart, I'm going to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. We're here to talk about Assassins Anonymous, but we've talked about a lot more than that. You've given us some great ideas for future reads, and we'll look for a dark space. Thanks so much for being with us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.